Blog Talk Radio.
I would like to welcome you guys to the Nation Billing, where it all goes down. I want to welcome your host, Queen Aziza Marion Mohammed Gidget. What's up, Sister Gidget?
Assalamu alaikum, DJ Black Caesar. How are you, dear brother?
Walaikum salam, sister. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I am blessed. I'm blessed by Allah's grace. And I am so excited about doing this show tonight because we have with us this evening my brother, my friend, Reverend Conrad Tillard. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, sister, to you and your brother. Assalamu alaikum. I'm doing fantastic. It's good to be on your show. I can't believe we're finally doing it. We've been talking about it, but now it is actually taking place.
Yes, sir, it is. It is. In all good time. As long as we get
right.
it in before the election,
that's the key thing.
That's the key thing. Okay, so we're going to start now. Comrade, is that okay if I call you comrade?
Sure, or would you prefer? Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know, we know you from the Nation of Islam, known as the hip hop minister from, you know, back in the day. And, you know, you have just embarked on a new spiritual as well as a political journey. But, you know, before we get started talking about you, I want to tell you something that I shared with your campaign manager, Mr. Gene Johnson, who has been so gracious and so helpful, is that I wanted to publicly and personally thank you for being that long-distance shoulder and that long-distance ear for me at a very, very dark time in my life, and I know you know what I'm talking about. And I just, you know, we've talked periodically here and there, and I never got the chance to thank you, dear brother. So I just want you to know that I thank you so much, and your words of wisdom stayed with me, and they stay with me constantly, and I just want to thank you for being who you are to me personally and who you just are as a person. So I wanted to make sure.
I thank you very much, and, you know, I thank you for being who you are, and, you know, we just have to always look out for each other and support each other the best we can. And I know you've been a great sister. You've supported many people. And, you know, anytime I can be of service.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Okay, so you're running for city council for the 36th District in Brooklyn, New York. But tell us a little bit about your educational background, because I know you went to Middlebury College in Vermont. But just kind of give us some more insight on your educational background.
Well, yes, I did. I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, but it was too cold and there weren't enough black people up there. So I transferred to the University of Pennsylvania. And that's where I did most of my college, and I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree. And then later I went on to Harvard Divinity School and graduated from Union Theological Seminary at Columbia University. And then I did a master's degree, I won't say final, because we never know when our education ends. I did a master's degree at Princeton Theological Seminary, and actually I am also in a doctoral program right now. I'm just on leave up at Andover Newton Theological Seminary up in Boston. That's the oldest seminary in the country. So God has blessed me to pursue a formal education. God has blessed me to get a lot of practical experience, and as I always say, a degree from the School of Hard Knocks as well.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. We all been there. Okay, so you are the father of, correct me if I'm wrong, five now?
Yes, five children.
And tell us about those beautiful children that have grown up so fast.
Yes, I have four sons and one daughter. And I'm very proud of them. My children range in age from 22 to 3. So they keep me busy. I am extremely proud of them. And I have enjoyed the joys of fatherhood for all of these 22 years. And I continue to enjoy it. It's challenging, but it's the kind of challenge that is great, and I am just so pleased. Two of my children are in college, and one is graduating from high school on his way to college, and then there'll be two more in the house. One's a freshman in high school, and as I said, I have a three-year-old, so they keep me busy.
Yes, sir. And that youngest little God in your house, beautiful, beautiful son. And share with us what his name is.
Well, you know, he was born in April 2009. So that means he was born right around the time of the election of Barack Obama. And I was so inspired by what the president did in that race, that he is named Barack Chad Joseph Tillard. So he is named after the president. I saw a funny cartoon around that time, and it said, kindergarten 5 years from now. This was the year the president was elected. And it said, it showed a bunch of kids in the classroom, and they all said their name was Barack and Michelle and Obama, and I think that was a funny cartoon, but it was also very true in that African Americans were filled with great pride. I still have friends who are my age, talking about black friends, that are named John Fitzgerald. So you know,
right.
People get have pride, and certainly I was proud of the first black president. So he is actually named after the president, Barack Tillard.
All right, that's a lot to live up to, but I've seen him, and looks like he looks like he's up for the challenge.
Well, I tell him I tell him he's going to be greater than the president and greater than his dad. So I think he will achieve.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And your wife Tamika, is she front and center out here with you, or? You know, I've seen her. Of course, she's very supportive, but, you know, is she ready for this arena?
Yes, well, my wife, her name is actually pronounced Temeca, and she is very supportive, and she herself works in Bed-Stuy. She's working at an organization called SIBS, and their mission is to improve Bedford-Stuyvesant. So we live in Bedford-Stuyvesant. We work in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Our lives are very much centered in the community. So, yes, she's ready, and she's a part of everything that we're doing.
Okay. That's a blessing. So, Comrade, you are still known as the hip-hop minister.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk to you about how do you feel about the drastic change in hip-hop music, because it's more vulgar, more sexually explicit, and more violent now than when you first started. And please enlighten us about your program called Change, that you spell C-H-H-A-N-G-E.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, one of the things that people should know is that I never actually called myself the hip-hop minister. That was a title given to me by a writer here, a brother by the name of Peter Noel. He wrote for the Village Voice at the time. I didn't like Peter much then. We've become great friends since then. But when he would write about me when I was at number 7, I was very young. People fail to realize that I was 23 years old when I was sent to New York as the National Youth Minister. At 26 years old, I was appointed the Minister of Mosque Number 7. So Peter felt that and he did it derisively when he wrote about me as this little hip-hop minister. I had the privilege and the blessing of being the Minister of Mosque Number 7 in the great era of hip-hop. In the great era of the hip hop, the golden age of hip hop, and so I was really blessed to be a part of this great movement at this great time. And there were so many people that were involved in hip hop that was uplifting, inspiring, positive. I mean, you interacted, and we interacted daily with people like Chuck D, KRS-One, Lauryn Hill, Guru from Gangstar, Pete Rock, CL Smooth, Afrika Bambaataa. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And so the mosque was on 125th Street. Dapper Dan's clothing store at the time was right around the corner. We were on 5th Avenue. He was on 125th Street. So it was there in the 80s when I first got to New York, crack era New York. There were a lot of people addicted to drugs. There was a lot of energy in the city, and a lot of it was very negative. As you know, you had people like Donald Trump taking out full-page ads, calling the young brothers from Central Park, the Central Park kids who were falsely accused, and who've since been vindicated, calling them a pack of wolves. Mayor Koch was just leaving office, but he was still in power, and Dinkins was about to come in. So New York was a very, very controversial, provocative, and tense-filled place. But out of all of that negativity, you had these wonderful brothers and sisters in the hip-hop community that were really inspiring young people. You know, back in the 80s, people don't realize this, but in New York in the 80s, you couldn't get brothers to call each other niggers. They didn't even... The word nigger was not even used in street culture in New York. The word brother or B was used, or God, but you never heard anyone in the streets of New York refer to anyone as a nigger, and if you did, they were fighting words. So it was a very different era, and you're right. Eventually, I did embrace the hip-hop minister title, and we founded an organization called Movement for Change, Conscious Hip-Hop Activism, Necessary for Global Empowerment, and we said that hands that once scratched turntables would one day pick presidents. And we said that if you love the hood, you ought to run for office in the hood. If you can sell a million records, you can get 10,000 votes. You'll be the city councilman. You can get 20,000. You'll be the congressman, the state senator, and you'll be able to deliver goods and services to the hood. Now, when I see Jay-Z and Beyonce interacting with the president of the United States, that was the vision of a movement for change, and that's what we talked about. We registered tens of thousands of young people across the country. Kwame Kilpatrick, we encouraged him. He was a state representative then. There were others around the country, and that was the hip-hop generation. So we're very proud of the legacy of Movement for Change. Unfortunately, hip-hop is, as you said, it's gone in a completely different direction. And lastly on that point, see, back then it was a youth culture. It was a genuine youth culture. Now it's just something that the music industry and the multinational corporations are selling to our young people. It's not a culture anymore.
Right. And I just want to ask you one more thing about hip-hop,
sure,
and I
sure.
always ask this question when I get the opportunity.
Sure.
Because, you know, Tupac Shakur still... After all these years, after his transition, still is, to me, our very best jewel
uh-huh.
in
uh-huh.
hip-hop. And uh-huh. In your opinion, do you feel that his death was politically related because
well,
of his message,
you know,
in the music?
I don't know. I can't say that. I do know I met Tupac. One of the sad things of my ministry is that when I was the minister of Mosque Number 7, you know, and I talked to Tupac. I used to talk to him at one point in particular when he was on trial in New York. Many of you will see the picture of him coming out of the courthouse for the rape trial in a wheelchair. He had been shot in Times Square.
Right.
And it was the brothers from Mosque Number 7 that were taking him out of that courtroom. And so I talked to him in those days. I met him, ironically, in a club. I was introduced to him by the brothers, and we talked quite a bit. And we talked when he was in jail. In fact, one of the worst decisions I ever made, I remember one day we were at Mosque Number 7, and I was scheduled to drive up to visit Tupac. and my car was parked outside. And at the time, it was Brother Minister Nelson from the Bronx, and we were supposed to drive up. He was the prison minister in New York State Penitentiary, but it was a long drive upstate, maybe 4 or 5 hours. I can't quite remember. But I got so tied up, and we were really excited about going to see him. He was excited about seeing us. But I didn't make it out of the mosque that day in time to get up there to see him, so I never did go. And the next thing I knew, I turned around. He was out of prison, and he was under the custody of Suge Knight. And when he got under death row, I saw a tremendous change in him. And I believe that, I don't know if it was political, I can't say that, but I was a part of all of that that was going on with the East Coast, West Coast rap. And I pleaded with Suge Knight. I pleaded with Tupac. I pleaded with Biggie in that era that we were killing each other and that we needed to come together. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. You know, he was killed in Vegas. And after that, I called basically the world of hip-hop to Harlem, and we had a wonderful celebration that day, and Puffy and Biggie were supposed to come. Puffy sat in my office there with Captain Dennis, and he said he would come, but then he came back and said that we were destroying his deal, and I don't know what deal that was, but I know that Biggie was supposed to be there, Tupac, and I told them it would have been important in the healing process that they be there. And Suge Knight was sent representatives, and I thought it would be a great opportunity to bring a healing. I had gone on Angie Martinez's show that day when I found out he died, and called the whole hip-hop community to the mosque. And it was a great day. Tupac's biological father, Bill Garland, William Garland, came, and we brought a healing, but unfortunately Puffy and Biggie did not come, and I've always believed that there was a healing process that was starting that day, and if they had come, I believe that perhaps Biggie would not be dead. A year later, he was dead. So I don't know, Sister Gidget, I can't say, but I do know this, that unfortunately, the great gifts, the genius of Tupac, unfortunately was one side of him, and unfortunately, at a certain point, I think he became enamored with death. He became enamored with the street life. And unfortunately, I believe that was the cause of his death. But he left a great legacy. There's no question about that. His music still stacks up. The positive and the negative music stacks up in terms of its thoughtfulness and in terms of its profundity. Even songs that he did, like Me and My Girlfriend, about a gun. I mean, as morbid as that topic is, or as negative as that topic is, when you think about what a gun has done in the lives of our young people and why he felt that him and a gun represented something significant, just the double entendre, the profound way in which he approached the track, not to mention Keep Your Head Up, Brenda's Got a Baby, all the wonderful things that he did, that's a legacy that he left with us. And I don't see anything in hip-hop today that comes close to what he's doing. But then again, I don't listen to it as much as I used to, but in my judgment, what I'm hearing today is not what he brought forth. It's not what C.L. Smooth brought forth. It's not what Sister Lauryn Hill brought forth, who also, in my judgment, right, one of the greatest artists of that era.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that and your very illustrious journey in hip-hop history, which you certainly played a very, very big part in. And I remember all those days, and I'm counting the years and counting the gray hair as well.
Yeah,
makes me feel old.
But you know, I do want to say lastly on that, I think there was a period when we could have and I still believe it's possible because I believe in hope, but there was a period when rappers listened to conscious strugglers. As you know, they sat with the minister often, and as you know, down in Texas, Brother Khalid Abdul Muhammad had a profound relationship with the rappers, and I had a great relationship with the rappers, and there was a time when rappers would listen and they sought to uplift in consciousness. And I think at a certain point, the industry took over hip-hop, where it was no more a culture. And I'm sorry, people don't like to hear this, but I fault people like Russell Simmons and others that essentially delivered black youth to these companies. And it was no more an authentic youth culture. It was more about what can we sell. The more it bleeds, it leads. The more these young people get arrested, the more credibility they will have, the more records they will sell. And that's when you start getting people who weren't from any hard life, weren't compelled to do things that were negative because they came from negative circumstances, whatever that means. And it became a fad to dumb down young people, and everything became about negativity, pimping and hoes and drug dealing, and this wonderful art form is no longer today. Common had a song called "I Used to Love Her," and I agree with that. Khalid used to say in another context, "I didn't leave, it left me." Well, certainly with hip-hop, I didn't leave it. I didn't stop listening to it until it stopped saying things that I could hear, because I don't have a great a capacity for ignorance and the degradation of my people. So if you're talking about things uplifting my people, I'll love it. But when you're degrading my people, I don't care if it's Amos and Andy, Eddie Cantor, I don't want to hear it. Because it's not what I'm about.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And thank you for that, comrade. And I want to talk about your pastorship, because you have done remarkable work in your church. And you know me, I'm your sister. I'm going to be following. I'm going to be looking. So, you know, you have brought together families. You have done work with men in the community.
Yes.
And tell us more about the mission of your church.
Well, the mission, you know, I have served three congregations in my ministry. Mosque number 7, Elliott Congregational Church in Roxbury, and Nazarene Congregational in Bed-Stuy. And I would have to say that all of my ministry has simply been about serving our folks, serving our people, trying to seek justice for those who are locked out, left out, and those who are at the bottom rung of society, middle class, working class, poor people, and people of every walk of life. I have never had a ministry, nor am I ever interested in a ministry that's so heavenly bound that it's no earthly good. I believe that ministers, whether they're in the mosque, synagogue, or the church, if they sideline their ministry by being irrelevant, only engaging in doctrinal conversations that only the most ardent followers even care about, then I believe that ministry is in danger now of being sidelined in modern society. The most effective ministries in the world, when you think of ministries, when you think of the great ministries of people like Adam Clayton Powell, people like Albert Klieg, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, when you think of people like all of the giants, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Minister Farrakhan, Calvin Butts, ministries that address the needs of people and speak to societal conditions are ministries that, in my judgment, they are the most fruit. They won't always be the popular ministries. Jesse Jackson is not popular today, but no one can deny what his ministry has meant to black people over 40 years. And when he's finished and his ministry is done, you have to go back to when he taught us, I am somebody. Respect me, protect me, never neglect me. I am God's child. My clothes are different. My hair is different. My face is different, but I am somebody. I may be black. I may be poor. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. You have to deal with Jesse when he said, choose hope for your brain rather than dope for your veins, and keep hope alive. So people, you know, when you do an effective ministry, it's not always going to be popular. We know the Lord Jesus Christ's ministry had some highs. There were times when he spoke to the multitudes, and then there were times when he was not popular at all. But the profound ministries last forever. Nobody's going to remember 100 years ago from now that you were talking about watch this, watch this, watch this, and just spending a lot of time talking about doctrinal issues. We've got to make religion real to the people. We've got to insert ourselves in public conversation, public discourse, you know, otherwise then the ministry becomes an irrelevant relic that people come every once a Sunday in fulfillment of religious duty, and fewer people are even doing that. So I challenge all ministers, whatever they're rabbis, imams, pastors, preachers, priests, you know, a ministry has to be relevant, and it has to be relevant to meet the needs of the people. So when Kyle Coppin, a young man, was shot here holding a hairbrush in Bed-Stuy, police said it was a gun, it was a hairbrush, I opened up the doors of the church so that his family could bury him. They didn't have a church home, but we had his funeral at Nazarene. One day I was walking down the street, and some of the brothers said, Rev, we got to do something about the police stopping and harassing us. Gave me a ticket for drinking water in front of my house, said it was public drinking. Well, then in a week, we had a town hall meeting addressing the issue of stop and frisk in New York. And the issues go on and on and on. The Freedom Party, that Charles Barron and Alton Maddox started in New York, trying to get a line, a ballot line, where black people could run for governor in New York, started in my church. So the ministry, whether you follow my ministry from Mosque Number 7 in Harlem to Roxbury in Boston to here in Bed-Stuy, it's always been about trying to be relevant to people who are religious and spiritual, but they also live in a material world.
Yes, sir. And, you know, I noticed that you named some of the giants, as you titled them, in ministries, but I guess you were being modest when you failed to mention that you, my dear brother, have been selected as Pastor of the Year this year.
Yes.
And that in 2006, you were elected as one of the most influential spiritual leaders in the United States. Tell us about that.
Well, only thing I say about that is that I'm still working in my ministry, and I still have a lot of work to do. If my members and people who I have served over the years want to make that statement about me, then I'll leave that for them to do. I just mentioned the ones that I look to, the ministries that have always been an inspiration to me and have been sort of instrumental in my own development and my own personal theology. Because, you know, every minister, and you know this because this is true of every believer in any faith, you start out by knowing, holding on, and believing to what people tell you about faith. When our mothers, our fathers, grandmothers, grandparents took us to church, Sunday school, to the mosque, wherever they took us, they taught us about faith and God. And we accepted it, we embraced it to the extent that we did. But there comes a point in your life and your faith journey where you're not going by what somebody told you, you're going by what you've seen yourself. And so there are great ministers, and I'm grateful to all of them that have inspired my ministry. But over the last 20 years, God has blessed me to develop my own personal theology, and I don't have to say what somebody told me about what God will do. God has shown me, and he walks with me, he talks with me, and I have a direct and clear relationship with God that's unshakable, unbreakable. And so I just do my ministry, and maybe if I continue to work, maybe those who I've served will one day say those things about me. I don't know if they will. They may call me a dirty dog, but the thing that I know is that I have served, I have worked, I've been concerned, consistent, and committed, and my work continues every day. And so, you know, that's the only thing I know. I don't know whether it's a great ministry. I appreciate all awards, honors. I put them on my office shelf, and I just keep on rolling.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's just you having that humble spirit, you know, that you have. And I know we have questions for Comrade, and we're going to get to a question segment, so please just stand by just a few more minutes and bear with us. I want to get through this part of the interview, and then we will open up for questions. So thank you for your patience. Those of you, let me remind you, if you're in the chat room and if you have a question for Comrade, please type your question in. And those of you who are listening via telephone, please press 1 on your keypad, and I will take your question at that time. Okay, Comrade, from
yes.
what I understand, did you author the book yet, In My Father's
well,
House?
Well, the book is still in process.
Okay.
You know, when we first agreed to do a book, I always felt that the book would come out when it was ready. You know, life is very interesting. Had I done the book at any point earlier, then so much would have been missed. And so my attitude is I've had a very unique and interesting journey, but thank God it's still evolving. So whenever, you know, God sees fit that we're able to complete the book, we have one manuscript, but that may change, that may be altered, that more might be added. So we just keep on working, but the book will be out, I guess, in due season. We came close, but I always believe it was God's plan that when it comes out, it'll be ready. I mean, I'm only 48 years old, so, you know, to write a memoir at 48 is a great thing, but, you know, sometimes it's better to wait till you've done more living, and because you're meeting different milestones, different challenges, new aspects of your life are unfolding every day. So it'll be out soon, I believe, but I've put that in God's hands because I'm still working. I'm still doing my work.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And, you know, I have done several shows in the past throughout, you know, the whole time we've been doing Blog Talk, and we have so often addressed the issue on the condition of our people. But I want to
mm-hmm.
ask you, you know, in your opinion, what do we need, and particularly when it comes to the condition of our youth and our men who are being incarcerated by the
right.
thousands, and then the youth in particularly who, you know, we don't have the community leaders that we once had in different communities, even in Compton, California, or even in Houston, Texas, and all over, you know, different cities throughout the country. You know, you didn't have a Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or even a Comrade Tillard, but there were men in the community that took on the role of leadership,
right.
whether they were a pastor or whether they were just fathers
right.
of the children or grandfathers.
Right.
So, in your opinion, what is needed in the community to inspire men to turn their lives around and stop going to prison. Because, yes, there is incarceration, and, yes, there is railroading, but, yes, there's also activity that is going on amongst our people that is making them susceptible to be incarcerated. But then we don't have anything to offer them. But how can we inspire them to do something different other than incarcerated?
I think, first of all, we have a crisis of culture in the African-American community, in the black community. I think the first thing is we have to be very clear that we have embraced a culture that is leading toward our death, our incarceration, and there's no nobility in that. There's nothing heroic. That's why it was so easy for me to make a strong critique of hip-hop, because I called them then, and I call many of the rappers today now, not the positive rappers, not true adherents of hip-hop culture, but the commercial rappers, I call them Pied Pipers of Death. And they have led our young people to death. When you talk about people like 50 Cent, whenever you promote images of drug dealers, whenever you promote images of criminals and killers, you're just acting. That's just, you got a costume on. You're making millions of dollars in studios. But what you're doing is you're promoting something to young people that don't have the basic common sense or intelligence to understand that indeed 50 Cent goes home to a mansion in Connecticut. He socializes with mostly wealthy whites, corporate types, music industry types, socialites. And it's not just him, it's many of these rappers who, my judgment, have Rick Ross. I would imagine that if you go home with Rick Ross or you hang out with him, you would see more wealthy people than poor people. And yet the young people in the cities, in Bed-Stuy, in Harlem, in South Bronx, and South Jamaica, Queens, in Texas, in the Bloody Five, Fifth Ward, Houston, and various neighborhoods in Texas and all over the country, they have taken on this lifestyle, and more and more and more of our young men go to prison. I can't ever, I don't see anyone whose art, whose teachings, whose philosophy leads to death and destruction as a heroic figure. I'm sorry. I am not impressed. I'm not enamored. I don't see any nobility in people, and I don't think they do it because they're ignorant. I think they do it because they're indifferent. And unfortunately, there are plenty of leaders. I've always said, I don't care, you can take me to the worst community in Dallas, Texas, and I assure you that the majority of people there go to work, they're honest, and they're decent. And there's only a few pimps. I've never been to a community that was just overwhelmed with pimps. I've never been in a community where most of the women were prostitutes. I've never seen a black community, and I was in Harlem in the worst days of crack, in Bed-Stuy, in the worst days of crack. And yes, there were plenty of crackheads, but there were 100 times more decent, honorable people trying to do the right thing in their lives. And so I don't know why our young people have become so enamored with a death style. I don't know why black people in general love things that are self-destructive. But if we would ever wake up, and I believe we will before it's all over, we would see that we have a crisis of culture. We have to get back to the basics. We have to get back to, first of all, loving ourselves, seeing value in ourselves. We have to put down criminality and the whole the fascination with gangsters and all of this, because it's doing nothing more than leading us to death. I'll tell you, John Gotti was the biggest gangster in New York at one time. Carlo Gambino, big gangsters. They had sense enough to say they were plumbers. I mean, these guys sold more drugs, killed more people, but they didn't go around saying they were gangsters. They said they were plumbers, okay? That's what their employment was listed as. And so we go around saying we're gangsters. And so I believe there's a crisis of culture. We need to get back in churches, get back in mosques, get back in communities, join organizations. As bad as we can critique where we went wrong with in the 60s and with some of these organizations, you can talk about the NAACP till the cows come home. You can analyze any organization in our community, but I assure you, we were better off when we were in these organizations than we are now. We're better off when we were in days gone by. And so one of the things that we're going to have to do if we're going to survive, Sister Gidget, is we're going to have to denounce and reject the idea of criminality, because it is that's the pretext that society is using to put us all back on plantations. And that's why men aren't on campuses, they're not in the community. But if you go behind the walls of the prison, I was in Sing Sing the other day with beautiful brothers, and most of our men are in jail, and we've got to stop more and more kids from going to jail.
And, you know, earlier this year or last year, I can't even remember, you know, Minister Farrakhan put the FOI in the street, or he led them to the street, so mm-hmm. to speak. And reports around the country how violence was certainly down during that time. Excuse me, as a model, would that work for our communities if the men would take on that role?
Well, I think that is what we need. That's great. But I think the problem is, and this is where we've got to, it's unavoidable. See, because the thing that kids listen to more than anybody, there's not one preacher in America that they listen to more than rappers, that they listen to more than this entertainment culture. And I still can't figure out how it is perfectly okay to demean blacks, as Rick Ross recently, and I'm glad that one of the shoe companies decided that they weren't going to finance their foolishness, and they finally today, I think, cut him off. But he made a very disparaging statement about rape. And then Lil Wayne. See, as long as you have these forces in the children and the young people's ear, you don't have enough soldiers or men or deacons to put in the street to overcome this madness. And that's why serious black people are going to have to get together and acknowledge that we've lost our children. We've lost them to pop culture. We've lost them to entertainment figures that pump into their heads values, messages, and we have not been able to overcome that. And therefore, we're going to have to be like other people. You know, you can say anything you want about black people, but you certainly can't say anything you want about other groups, because they don't tolerate it. And as long as we allow radio stations to promote and get rich off of people portraying drug dealers, killers, and in the name of our community, then there's nothing we will be able to do to overcome the influence that these influences have on our young people. We've got to go to war with them. I said that back in 2000. I said it back in 1998, 1999, and many of the leaders said that, no, brother, it's not the blacks, it's the enemy, it's whites behind the scenes. And, no, brother, you got to try to work with the young people. But I've seen too many of these rappers sit with preachers and leaders and ministers and get right back up and go make a song more negative than the one that they made before. So we got to say our dignity has to be important to us. And we're going to have to boycott these record companies, these movie studios, the same way we did the bus companies in Montgomery and Birmingham. Because I'm telling you, you can't talk enough. I can't talk enough. Jesse, Minister Farrakhan, the great preachers, T.D. Jakes, you can't talk enough to out-influence these negative influences that are coming into the heads of our young people. And that, I believe, is going to either make or break our community. If we don't confront these forces, then I'm sorry to say that we are continuing to see our young people go to jail. Think about this, Gidget, lastly on that point. If a young person in your town every day listens to the quote-unquote urban station, if they listen to that radio station in the morning when they're showering to go to school, if as soon as they get home they turn it on and they're listening to it all night, just think of how many times they've heard men speak to women in a way that's degrading, how many times they've heard the N-word, how many times they've heard people who sell drugs be celebrated, how many times they've heard and ungodly messages, how many times have they heard issues of rape or the destruction or the violation of black women's bodies and their own bodies. So there's just no way around it. There's no substitute. You can't. There are buckets, oceans of negativity pouring into the minds of our young people. And at best, the best organizations, the biggest churches we have, they are using tablespoons to scoop out the negativity in the minds of our young people while oceans are pouring in.
Wow, that's deep, but it's true. It's true, Conrad. It's true. And you know, we just have to keep working and try new things until we get it right. Okay, I'm going to open up the lines now for anyone who has a question for Conrad. And DJ Black Seas, I think we have a question from area code 716. They've been holding for a while. Let me remind all of you again, if you have questions for Conrad or myself, and you're in the chat room, please type in your question. I will ask it on your behalf. Those of you who are listening by phone, press 1 on your keypad, and we will take your question. Area code 716.
And look, just before you do that, can I say those that live in New York City, I don't want to forget that, you know, right now I'm fighting a very important campaign and election. Go to my website, Conrad for Council. If you, first of all, anyone anywhere in the country, go to my website, Conrad for Council. Go to that donate page and make a donation to our campaign. But if you're in New York, go to the donate page, go to the volunteer page. Get involved. We have to transform these communities, and we can't just put politicians in office. Bed-Stuy really needs someone who can inspire, who can uplift, who can teach, because this community is one of the most important communities in New York, and we can't lose it the way Harlem is being lost. We've got to stand up, and I'm hoping people will get behind my campaign.
Yes, sir. Okay, and caller from area code 716, you have a question?
Yes, I do.
Okay, go
Am
ahead,
I on
sir.
Air?
Yes, sir, you are?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. Peace and love, Brother Conrad. This is Brother
Grace and,
Brother
Javid
Muhammad from Buffalo, New York.
Oh, yes. How are you doing? Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, I just want to, yes, sir, it's good to hear you and good to see your good work.
Did you say Halim?
You know, I always, as a young Muslim growing up in the mosque, admired your wonderful example as a sharp minister, and I... you know, I always saw you as a great example. And so I looking at your transition, I didn't say Halim, I said David.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I got you. Okay, I thought you said Halim. I'm sorry.
Oh, I know Brother Halim very well, though.
Okay.
Yes, sir. In your transition, in the various the congregations that you pastored,
mm-hmm.
All the way from Mosque Number 7, and also in Boston, and now in Brooklyn, I wanted you to speak to, and I know you have you're running for city council as well,
mm-hmm.
but I wanted you to speak to overcoming these religious divides and
mm-hmm.
religious division and the different division. That has to be overcome in order for us to effectively work together to address some of the conditions that you mentioned that are affecting our youth today.
Well, I agree with you. you know, one of the things that we're going to have to understand, and I'm grateful to all of the leaders who have been interfaith and ecumenical in their orientation. Back in the 50s, 30s, 40s, Malcolm X and Christian pastors debated, and many people in those days could not see the value and understand that in any African village, in any African city, you have all religious traditions. You have Muslims, you have Christians, you have those who practice traditional African faiths. So we have to understand that, you know, people have different spiritual expressions. In our own families, we have different faiths. So one of the things that I've always done, and certainly hold on to that now, is that wherever a person is coming from spiritually, I respect it, and I understand and appreciate the different expressions of faith. And as you said, at the end of the day, it's been said long before us that we've got to come together and work together, because there's a thread that runs through certainly the Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but that same thread runs through Hinduism, Buddhism, and all faiths, and that is that religion causes you to be decent. Religion causes you to look for the best in humanity, to understand that there is a God who is greater than you, and that that God has certain standards that we're expected to live according to. And in their base interpretation, the purest interpretation of those faiths, it is that we've got to work to live with our fellow man, to be in unity, and to make society a place where people can live and yearn to be free. We respect the creation of God. And so, in my judgment, I think we do a lot better about that today. I mean, when you see Ms. Farrakhan and Father Flager, Catholic priest and a Muslim minister together, when I first met Minister Farrakhan, he was with Jesse Jackson. And I was working with Reverend Jesse Jackson, and that was a Muslim and Christian coming together, and we have brothers and sisters in our community that are Jews and other religions. So the problem is not our religion. So we need to be very clear about that. The problem that we have is people who don't have a religion are getting all of our children, and that's why we've got to put our differences aside. First, there shouldn't even be any difference. It's just different expressions, and come together and say, you know, Muslims, Christians, Jews, people of African faith, none of them want to see their children using drugs, using guns to kill each other, and degrading themselves. So there's great commonality if we could keep focused on that and not debate over doctrine, what you believe, what I believe. You like to speak in tongues or hoop when you preach, and I worship quietly. I wear a suit and bow tie. You wear a jalopy. I mean, these are things that we are overcoming, thank God, and we need to continue to overcome, because society has great problems, and we're the voice. All us together are the voice that can help bring more clarity, as long as we're not fighting and killing each other over doctrine.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you, Reverend Conrad, for your all of your work and your great example. I do have to do a funeral tomorrow for a young man who was shot and killed in a community that we're working with the young brothers and sisters in a troubled community. And I wanted to, if you were, you mentioned about the funeral for a young man who didn't have a church home. And so here's a young man here in Buffalo who was trying to come to the mosque on occasion, and he was a humble brother seeking, but he was still caught up in that life. And so now his street family is going to be has been left behind. What would you say to those, his family, and to his you know, his comrades who will be there tomorrow?
Well, you know, it's always difficult to funeralize our young brothers and sisters who have died, particularly to violence. And, you know, I have been blessed and cursed to have to do that here in New York, in Harlem, Brooklyn, and up in Roxbury, and all over the country. And I think that the thing that I think is most important is, number one, your service is to give dignity to the life of the young person who's dead, and to explain the great mystery, the great why, to those who are living. Death is something that perplexes all of us. And as clergy, we have a great example and a great responsibility to try to bring clarity for the living and help them to understand the great why. But also, when you have that captive audience, it's always, as you know, I'm sure, our obligation to try to help them understand that there's something bigger than them, and that we need to develop a relationship with God so that we can understand the full meaning of life. And I'll tell you, I'm sure this is true in the mosque, it's certainly true in the church, that more and more funerals that we do, we are preaching and teaching more and more to people who have not the basic, the most basic understanding of theology. And so it's a great opportunity to teach. It's a great opportunity to convert and bring people to faith. But it's also a great responsibility on our shoulder, because folk are coming in and they don't belong to any religious house. They don't know how to reverence the dead. They don't know how to conduct themselves in a funeral. And we have to be real strong as clergy to help them to understand that, wait a minute, you know, this is an individual whose life is gone, and this means something. This is important. And give me a few moments to work with you and wrestle with you and share with you what this great mystery is all about. So I wish you the best of luck, and I'll be praying for you. It's a great opportunity to teach and bring clarity to those who are still alive.
Yes, sir. Okay, thank you once again.
God bless you, my brother.
Peace and blessings.
God bless you.
Thank you for your question. Okay, DJ Black Trees, I think we have one from St. Louis, area code 314. Can you make that mic live? Assalamualaikum, Brother Kareem.
Wa alaikum salam, Queen Aziza. How you feeling?
I am blessed by Allah's permission. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. All praises due to Allah, who came in the person of Master Farad Muhammad. And first, I want to thank you, and of course, DJ Black Caesar, who's engineering, but for bringing this on and doing this interview with Reverend Conrad.
Yes,
and,
my brother.
Yes, sir, because I don't really have a question. I have more of a statement, because I've been sitting back listening, and I want to say that in my humble estimation, you represent exactly what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told us we should have when it comes to entering into this arena known as politics. And I noticed just like the title of the show tonight, I mean, it's very appropriate, and it's the name of your campaign. It says Conrad for Council. I mean, that's
all right.
You understand what I'm saying? I mean, that's,
yeah, I do.
You are, I think I do. Yes, sir. You are actually providing the council. I mean, I'm listening, see, and I'm hearing. You know, people want to say, you know, they pick up on the spirit. Yes, that's fine. However, exactly what you're talking about, which is something that I talk about myself all the time and strive to live up to, is practical application. No matter where we are, we got to have practical application. And from what I can see, and this, I'll be honest with you, I've heard your name in the past, but this is my first time actually hearing you representing the God I know. You know what I'm saying? And, I mean, it's awesome is not a good enough word. Fantastic is not a good enough word. It's good. It's beautiful, to in my estimation, to see the God walking and talking. You see what I'm saying? That's
well,
cool.
Brother, I tell you, you really hit something tonight that I hadn't thought about, but I tell you something. One of the things that I definitely have said is that I think we made a critical mistake when we as a community began to turn away from preacher politicians. When you think about Adam Clayton Powell and the great example that he represented, his concern, his defiance, his love for the poor, the locked out. See, lawyers and political operatives will tell us, you know, how things go, how the system works. But it's the black ministers in our struggle that have always said this is the way it should be. So you actually are on to something, because I have said in Bed-Stuy, we need someone who can inspire us, who can help us inspire the young people, bring us together, and counsel us. So, brother, I appreciate that, because I hadn't even thought about that. So, man, you hit on something that we may look at. So thank you so much for
yes,
that
sir.
Observation. That was very profound.
Yes, sir. And I want to just leave you with one thing. And I'm going to get off here and listen some more, because I'll be real with you. I'm eating this up. I'm loving this. And it comes from the book Message to the Black Man, page 218. And it's the last paragraph on that page. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad says this. He says, we are a nation in a nation. Why not use these 22 million people's power for their eternal salvation instead of temporary enjoyment with the same wicked people who murder our people? Let us build our own political machine. And this is particularly for you, brother. All right? In other words, I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. Unite with Conrad and with the help of Allah, he will get you what you want, and he knows what you want, for he is your brother.
All right. Well, thank you so much. God bless you, my brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brother Kareem. And speaking of ministers, I cannot go on. We're going to talk about your campaign next.
Sure.
He don't have his hand up, but he's listening, and I'm calling on Minister James Muhammad out of Tampa, Florida.
Okay.
My beloved minister, brother, and friend.
Yes.
Your mic is live, whether you like it or not.
Oh, I thank you, dear Sister Gidget. And, of course, I could never, never allow this great interview to occur without my at least calling in and wishing my brother well and
well,
much
you,
success.
James. Thank you.
I firmly believe that the kind of ministry that you bring to politics, again, is the kind of ministry that needs to be inserted in the political process. I heard our decrying the fact that we're killing each other and there's a conflict of culture. And unfortunately, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan did say that the people are not going to change on preaching alone. And of course, that is supported scripturally in the parable of the dry bones in the valley.
Oh, yeah.
So we have to work fervently to beat that prophecy.
Right.
And, dear brother, I have every confidence that you will be a significant warrior in that battle. I encourage
you,
dear
brother. Well, I thank you,
brother
James. I thank you. I thank you, because I tell you, people who don't know, you're down in Florida now, but when I first got to New York from Philadelphia, Brother James initiated me on the streets of Harlem. And we spent many, many days walking and talking and sharing and working with the people in Harlem, and I learned every alley and every corner in Harlem from Brother James, and I just have the greatest respect for you and your wonderful family, and just wish you the best in all that you do a great man of God, and I appreciate your encouragement. I thank you so much.
And thank you, brother. And that was an extremely beneficial experience with you. And again, you're running for city council, I believe, and I'm going to close here, is just the beginning for you in the political arena. In my humble estimation, dear brother, there are great works that will tap your astuteness, that will tap your sincerity, which is greatly needed in the political world. So this is just the first step, brother, and may Allah continue to bless you.
I thank you so much.
Thank you,
I thank you so much, and you too, you as well. All right, my friend, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brother James.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to talk about your campaign now.
Sure.
Comrade, so now, you know, the seat is available due to term limits.
Yes.
Tell me, what inspired you to run for this seat?
Yes, well, you know, first of all, let me say that we've been represented by some great politicians in that city council seat. For the last 12 years, we've been represented by a giant in Brooklyn and New York politics, a brother by the name of Al Vann. And Al Vann was a great legislator up in Albany, our state capital, in the New York State Assembly. And then he came back to New York City. He was a teacher. Initially, he was in the teachers' movement of the 60s. He was involved in a very important case here in New York in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, a landmark case on community school boards. And he's been in the council for three terms, and he's term limited. He's about 70-plus years, so he's retiring as well. And, you know, Bedford-Stuyvesant and Harlem are two of the greatest African-American communities in the country and certainly in New York. And Bed-Stuy is great. You know, Shirley Chisholm came from Bed-Stuy. Great people. Sonny Carson came from Bedford-Stuyvesant. And Central Brooklyn, Crown Heights and Bedford-Stuyvesant. We've had people like Ed Towns, Major Owens. We've had, right now, we have all of the young black politicians in Brooklyn. Eric Adams is going to be our next first black borough president. Yvette Clark, young sister, is our congresswoman. Hakeem Jeffries, the nephew of Dr. Leonard Jeffries, is our congressman in Bed-Stuy. So there is an explosion of young black politicians in Brooklyn. You don't see that anywhere else in New York City. And so Brooklyn is the place. Brooklyn is the most populous community of African American, black Caribbean Americans in New York. And so I thought, you know, we've been working in the community. I always looked at the parish, not just the church, but the larger parish. And I've always looked at the people in the larger parish as my constituents. So it was a natural step to say, open seat. I do believe that we need to go back to the tradition of minister, preacher, politicians. And so we prayed on it. Family talked about it. We put together a solid campaign. And if people go to that website, Conrad for Council, they can go to find out what our platforms are, what the issues are. And I would love for somebody in your audience, folks in your audience, to go and make a donation. Hit that donate page. And if you live in New York, hit the donate and volunteer page, because this is one of the most important communities in black America. And we need to make sure we have someone of weight, of substance, of experience in that position. And since I have been concerned, committed, and consistent, I believe that, you know, you prepare for a while. I've had the great opportunity of working directly with Reverend Jesse Jackson, directly with Minister Louis Farrakhan, directly with Percy Ellis Sutton when I was at Inner City Broadcasting Corporation, directly with people like Butts and Sharpton and all of the great leaders across the country, I've been there. So in terms of my generation, I've been prepared, and you only stay in school for a certain period of time. You only pledge for a certain period of time. Then you have to step forward and provide that leadership yourself. And so as we make a transition from a man 70 to a man 48, it's a great time for me to step forward and provide that kind of leadership in Bedford-Stuyvesant. So I'm hoping people who live in Brooklyn, who have family members in Crown Heights and Bed-Stuy, because the district is actually Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights, they will go to that website, Conrad for Council, that's COUCIL.com, and get involved in this campaign. But I'm excited. This is my first campaign ever, and I'm very excited because I feel like, and I've always felt, that I'm called to ministry. There's no question about that. But I've also believed that I was called to engage the political process. And so this is a calling. I'm very clear about what I'm doing, and I'm excited. And I feel very strong about this campaign and very energized.
Yes, sir. And you know, for those of us who don't live in New York,
sure,
or are familiar with Brooklyn,
right,
just expound a little bit, if you would, on a daily basis, what is going on in the communities of Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights that brings such dissatisfaction to you, and what do you plan to change about those communities?
Well, we have the same issues that a lot of communities have, but we have something that a lot of communities don't. In Bed-Stuy, in central Brooklyn, and this is Bed-Stuy, do or die, that Biggie Smalls talked about. Biggie Smalls rapped about his apartment. He called it a one-room shack. Well, just the other day, that one-room shack sold for $700,000. So Bed-Stuy is unique in that you've always had a high, particularly significant high number of African-American homeowners. I'll tell you, the man across the street from me just sold his house recently. He was a subway driver, and he was able to buy his home back in the 1970s for $25,000 on the salary of a subway driver. He sold that home last month for $1 million+. So the bottom line is, yes, we have crime, we have failing schools, and we have great educators in this community, and our schools are failing not just because of the schools are failing, but in New York we have what we call mayoral control, and Mayor Bloomberg and his administration have decided they want to push charter schools, and I'll talk more about that later. They want to push smaller schools, so they're giving our good schools and our challenge schools arbitrarily negative grades. So we have all the challenges, but we also have some great opportunities and assets. Just this Saturday at my church, again, we can't be so heavenly bound that we're no earthly good. We had a workshop entitled Keeping It in the Family. It was co-sponsored by the Bridge Street Development Corporation and the Black Real Estate Board of Bed-Stuy. And this is a problem in Texas. It's a problem everywhere. Black people buy a home, they earn a home, they sacrifice, they save, they give it to their children, and in a few years they've lost it over water bills, they've lost it over unpaid taxes, and this happens all over the country. We had a seminar. We brought bankers, real estate professionals, tax professionals, estate planners together, and we taught the community when do you start planning to transition a home from one generation to the next? That question was asked. Some people said when you retire. Some people said when you get 50. Our experts taught us that you start planning to make that transition when you purchase the asset, and they showed us how to do it. So my point is, Bed-Stuy is a great community. As you know, Harlem has been significantly gentrified. You almost don't have the same political power that you once had in Harlem, Charles Rangel's seat, will probably go to the Dominican community, someone in either the Dominican community on the west side or the Puerto Rican community in East Harlem. But Bed-Stuy, Central Brooklyn, is the most important concentration of African-American people in this city. You have a lot of middle-class homeowners. When Sandy just hit us, everywhere else, Harlem, Lower Manhattan, the Rockaways, Coney Island, they were wiped out. But the way Bedford-Stuyvesant is strategically placed, we were blessed to be high and dry. So we've got to hold on to this community. We've got to make sure that people don't lose their homes. People who cared about this community and were here in the worst times, we've got to make sure that they have a place. And these are some of the issues that we're running to improve. I work very closely with Boys and Girls High School, the most important high school in this district. That's where some of our greats, Boys High and Girls High, Lena Horn graduated from Girls High. People like Lenny Wilkins, Connie Hawkins, Pearl Washington, even people like Norman Mailer and Isaac Asimov, they graduated from Boys High. It's the oldest public school in America, and it's in Brooklyn, and we're very concerned about that great school. So I could go on and on with the local issues, but I will say that if you're in South Central Los Angeles, if you're on the north side of St. Louis, if you're in Northwest or Southwest Philadelphia, it's the same issues that are facing African Americans everywhere. Washington, D.C., the issue of gentrification, and we've got to make a strong stand. And the only way we can do that is put strong and committed leaders into these positions. And that's why I'm running for city council in Central Brooklyn.
And, you know, Comrade, the economy has really hit everybody hard all over the country.
Yeah.
And in your opinion, on a national level, you know, how do you feel about how the economy is being handled? And are there any programs that you plan to implement in the 36th district to boost the economy there?
Yes. Well, you know, it's a very difficult economy. And part of why the economy is bad, of course, we know we're dealing with unsound fiscal policies of the Reagan, Bush, even Clinton administration, and, you know, the lack of regulation, NAFTA sending jobs, manufacturing jobs that once existed in the United States no longer exist anymore. And in Bed-Stuy, we have that same problem. One of the things that we've talked about in our plan is that small business is the largest employer in the United States. We know that we've got a lot of African-American men who have been to prison, who have felonies, and these men also have families. They have to have income. And when you don't have jobs in the community, people tend to turn to the underground economy. But we're saying to them, don't turn to the underground economy, because that's society's plan to put you back in jail. We're saying that, listen, if you can run a complex drug organization, you can open up a small business. You know, when you go to Chinatown in New York and other cities, most of these people that are working in the businesses, they don't have degrees. Most of them don't have high school diplomas. And yet they're gainfully employed. Why? Because they're working in a small business that is not looking for a degree from Howard, Harvard, but just wants them to be committed. And that's what we've got to do. If no jobs are coming back, and we have a plan to bring light manufacturing into certain areas that are deserted warehouse areas, brownfield areas in Bed-Stuy, we hope to entice small manufacturing in a neighboring community called Williamsburg. It's an Orthodox Jewish community, hipster community. You've got all kind of manufacturing taking place, all kinds of shops, metal shops and tile shops, marble shops. You have all kinds of light manufacturing taking place. We want to do that, but we also want to promote. We want to generate incubators to bring more small businesses to to our community. There is no reason when you have hundreds of thousands of people living in a community, there are always jobs, because if you're providing goods and services, then there's always an opportunity to make money. And so, again, once we get our story right, our heads right, once we reject criminal culture that is no more than a culture designed, a booby trap, designed to put us in prison, and we get together and we open up cleaners. We open, you know, in New York, a lot of the brothers coming out of prison have felonies. It's hard for them to get a barber's license. So people are making it increasingly difficult, but we can make it. We've made it in the past. We've had Black Wall Street. We've had remarkable successes in the past, and we can do it today. We just have to stop saying we can't do it, they won't let us do it, and we just have to get together and do it. And that's what we need. We need someone that will utilize the bully pulpit to draw upon the best traditions of Marcus Garvey and Clegg and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and Martin and all of those who said we can do it. And we need politicians that are not afraid to reference these important success stories in our community, because these individuals that I've mentioned, they predated what is going on in our community today. And their message was uplifting, hopeful, and we prospered in that climate. And today we are challenged because our greatest influences are not Martin King, they are not James Cone, they are not Cornel West or Malcolm X. Our greatest influence, to be honest with you, Black men in urban cities, is not even Barack Obama. Our greatest influence are entertainment figures who are paid handsomely by multinational corporations, and their message is a message of Pied Pipers of Death. And we've got to save the children, save the babies. And I'm convinced that we cannot have a deal with Satan. We cannot coexist with these corporations without ultimately challenging them, because they are, in my judgment, more culpable and responsible for young people going to jail. It'd be great if we had fathers in the home, if we had people who were more balanced, then yes, we live in a free society. You can make a movie about blowing up a school. But not when you have little white children like the little boys in Columbine or the little boy in Connecticut. We've got to take some stock of the images. I don't know why we're so surprised that these children are killing each other every time we turn on the TV. They are watching killing. And so we can't continue to exist where we say it's okay for people to continue to put out this kind of product. We've got to challenge them and call them to account, because what they're doing is ultimately unpatriotic, it's uncivilized, and it's actually undermining society as we know it. And I don't care whether you're in the ghetto, whether you're in the hood, or whether you're in Newtown, Connecticut, an affluent place that people move to escape the realities of the urban cities. Our culture is sick, and I'm not just talking about Black people. I'm talking about red, yellow, black, white, purple, green, blue, whoever. We have a sick culture, and we need to start addressing that issue. So these are things that I hope, as a city council person, to have a platform. We've talked, I'm not the only one that talks about this. Every good minister, every good leader talks about these things. But the problem is, as ministers, we have said in our churches, mosques, and we need to go to state houses, we need to go to city halls, we need to go to the legislatures and city councils so that this message can be heard even in a broader context.
Yes, sir. I so agree with you. And like in all the communities, especially the communities of color, you know, whether, like you say, whether they're Black, brown, or poor whites, we have lost so many essential services. Tell us about what essential services in Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights are being lost that you are striving to save at this point.
Well, as I mentioned, I've spent so much time dealing with education, but, you know, our seniors, we have to be very concerned about, you know, Reverend Jackson taught me this many years ago. We continuously balance the budgets of our cities on the backs of the poor. Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who is essentially a billionaire many times over, I think he came to office with $3 billion, and he has earned, now I think he's worth $25 billion. And New York has become, under his leadership, a place for the rich. The reason why Harlem, people don't understand this, the reason why Harlem has become gentrified, it's because the people who used to live downtown that had big money, Wall Street types even, they can't afford to live downtown anymore. And so they've now moved uptown. Then uptown got so expensive, they couldn't afford Harlem anymore. You couldn't buy a brownstone for less than $1 million. And now they've come to Bed-Stuy. I was in a place called Ridgewood, Queens, at a diner, speaking to an ethnic white diner owner, and he was talking about how the hipsters and the people with money were running them out of Ridgewood, Queens. I was in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which is an old Ralph Cramden neighborhood of Polish immigrants. They've been run out by the hipsters. In Washington, D.C., blacks have been forced out of the District of Columbia, now into Prince George's County, where many blacks came from, into Washington, D.C., because these cities are being run by mayors who have a market rate understanding. And so we've got to be concerned. What makes cities great is not just the bankers, but what city makes cities great are the teachers. We have to have affordable housing. I've got plans to have affordable housing for teachers and what we call change agents that live in the city, work in the city, police officers, firefighters who have to live in Long Island because they can't afford to live in New York City. So between the seniors, the youth, our middle class, I'm meeting with unions. Unions are finding that every time Bloomberg talks about balancing the budget, he wants to take something from the unions, and yet the bonuses continue to be paid on Wall Street. We just heard last night that Jay-Z is selling his interest in the Brooklyn Nets. We protested Bruce Radner and this Russian oligarch that were given huge tax subsidies by the city of New York. We can't build schools. We can't build hospitals and communities, but New York gave billions of dollars to a billionaire to build a basketball stadium. And now Jay-Z, after leading all the blacks in Brooklyn to support the arena, is now pulling out. But they were supposed to build housing for those tax subsidies. They were supposed to get money. They were supposed to build affordable housing. That has not been done. Someone in the city council needs to continue to hold their feet to the fire. Hold that money up. Hold those tax subsidies up. Take those tax abatements back if they refuse to do what they promised to do when they were given that opportunity to build that stadium to fleece, I mean, reap millions of dollars from the people in New York City and people from all over the world that support it. So these are some of the things. I mean, we have issues like charter schools, and I don't know how this movement is growing in Texas, but I do know that somehow people have developed the understanding that charter schools are the solution. And what I have said is that charter schools, you know, one of the great things about America is that America said early in its founding that there would be compulsory education for all of the children. It means they have to go to school. So if your parents are illiterate and they don't see the value of education, the law says they can't have you working on a farm. You got to go to school for until a certain age. If your parents just didn't feel like getting up to take you to school in the morning, the law said, no, you got to go to school. This was one of the great things about America that Europe didn't offer. You had to have money, prestige, and position. Everybody couldn't go to school in other parts of the world. And so compulsory education, public education, is very important. When you start giving millions of dollars to charter schools with no oversight, and these charter schools only educate in New York, 5% of our young people, where are the rest of them going to go to school? So I'm saying no. Charter schools are about making money. If you're going to give charters to people, give it to people who have been independent educators in our community. People like those who run Clara Muhammad Schools, Muhammad Universities of Islam, other independent Montessori schools, Afrocentric schools, people who know and care about our young people, who know how to educate our young people. McAdamy is a great school here in Brooklyn where you have a private educator. Stuyvesant Heights Montessori, where my son goes. You've got people who know how to educate black people, who care about poor people, urban young people. But what do? We give millions of dollars to charter school companies located in Texas or North Carolina that are educating and operating schools in Newark, Philadelphia, Chicago. And of course, once you put a private incentive in prisons and schools, then the hype is that we're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Dove soap, we don't know if it's the best soap, but when you privatize something, you make them make the claim that they're good, and we don't have the kind of oversight in New York that you need to have in order to make sure these charter schools actually are producing what they say they're producing. But all of that is on our website and many more of the detailed plans that we have. It's a new day in Brooklyn. It's a new Bed-Stuy, Crown Heights, and you need someone who's visionary and thoughtful to bring programs like this to the forefront in our community. And that's what we're doing. We've got a very thoughtful plan. Hey, as a minister, I have the advantage that others in the race may not have. There's one other minister. But I've been working on these problems for nearly 30 years. So I understand very clearly what the issues are facing families in this city and across the country, but particularly in Central Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy. So please, I urge you, go to that website. If you live in Texas, if you're in St. Louis, if you're in Philadelphia, Washington, wherever you are, just go there. You say, well, I'm not in New York. I don't have anything to benefit, but just do me a favor. If you support our ministry, the things that we've been doing, just go on that website, Conrad for Council. Make a small donation. Make a big, whatever you can do, it will help us greatly in this effort to win this council seat. There are four people in the race, and we want to work hard to make sure that September 11, 2013, we will have taken this program to the city council in the city of New York.
Yes, sir. And let me ask you, because another issue that plagues our community, Conrad, is health care availability.
Yes.
And, you know, medication is so costly to,
yes,
you know, just the working family, and then you have to consider the elderly who are on a fixed income and cannot,
absolutely,
afford their medications. What,
absolutely,
can we do, or what are you offering to do about health care availability in the communities?
Well, and again, this is where the importance of advocacy in the city council is combined with ministerial advocacy is very important. We're losing hospitals, community hospitals in Central Brooklyn. Interfaith is a full-service hospital in Central Brooklyn. It looks like now it's going to be merged with Long Island College Hospital, and it won't provide the full range of services. That's of great importance to me. I don't know how that happened. We need to investigate that and get to the bottom of that, because we have millions of people in Central Brooklyn, in Brooklyn, that need a full-service hospital, and so that's a top priority. But also, we have discretionary funds at the City Council, and there are programs that do meet the needs of seniors, of families, that we have the ability to fund and support. So it's not just saying, well, you know, you have a pulpit, why don't you just do it from there? I will. I will always be a preacher politician. I will never leave the pastorate. Ministry is my vocation. It is what I'm trained professionally to do. It's what I have experience doing. It is my field, my vocation. But this electoral aspect is just engaging society to on another level. You actually have the ability to determine where money goes, what programs get funded in your community. You have the ability to say what's going to survive, what's going to fail. You can work with groups and help to meet their needs. And so it is a great opportunity. And as you said, that's why I support universal health care that the president is trying to implement. And I would fight on every level that I could in New York City locally to protect the kinds of services that we provide to families. It is very costly. I just told you a man that bought a house for $25,000 in 1972 or 73 sold it for $1.3 million. This is in Bedford-Stuyvesant. A friend of mine who is a lawyer, very well compensated, made a offer on a house. And when I say a house, I'm talking about a brownstone, a row house, in a section of Bedford-Stuyvesant. And she made a $900,000 offer, and she said she wasn't going any higher. And there was a bid on the house that day. I don't know what that house went for, but what I'm saying is it is very costly to live in this city. And if you don't continue to provide services to seniors, young people, and middle-class people, they will drown in the city. They've drowned under Bloomberg, and it's time for a change. And we need people in the city council that will not just rubber stamp the mayor's agenda. Yes, the mayor has the executive mandate. He's elected by the whole city. But every city council person has a responsibility to advocate for the people in their district. And that's what we'll be doing. I ain't afraid of nobody. I'm not going to be bought off. And so I intend to take, by God's grace, the commitment that I've had to the city council, and in some of the conversations I've had at the pulpit and on the street corner, we'll be having those in the whole of the city council, on the floor of the council. And I think we, in all of Black New York and all of working class, middle class New York, will benefit from having someone as deeply concerned about them as me in the council. So I'm excited. Like I said, I'm excited. We're fired up. Every morning we get up and we hit the phones right now. We're raising money. As you know, you got to have money to run. But we're also organizing meets and greets. And we're in the community. We're preaching. We're sharing, working with young people. And I'm very excited what's taking place in Bedford-Stuyvesant at this time.
Yes, sir. And, you know, along with health care in our communities and particularly, you know, we have lost social services that were designated for children. You know, the Boys
right.
and Girls Clubs are closing
right.
down. The YM
right.
and YWCAs
right.
Are closing down. And after school programs that, you know, like Shape Community Center in Houston that are not
right.
being funded. Because
right.
the grant
right.
programs have ended.
Right.
What about social services for the youth?
It's vital. I mean, you know, as you said, you know, we had one of the greatest recreation centers in New York, the Brownsville Recreation Center. And let me tell you, this is one of the greatest recreation centers in the country. Brother by the name Greg Jocko Jackson. Former NBA player, came out of Brownsville. He ran that wonderful center that gave life to young people. He recently passed 2 years ago, I think it was now, and I'm told that he had a heart attack because he was fighting with the city administration to keep that program alive. It is absolutely true. You cannot in today's world. Turn these young people out in the streets, and we're getting exactly, we're harvesting exactly what we've planted. And so, again, you need people in the council when these conversations come up. What's going to be when the budget is drawn up? You got to have advocates. You got to have people that are willing to say no, and able to work with other people and say to the mayor and the mayor's budget office, no, you can't cut this service. You know, if you cut this, the results are going to be this. And you have, I mean, you'd be surprised the number of local elected officials that can be co-opted by mayors because they don't want to lose their perks, their privileges, and something they call Lulu's here, which gives you an extra $20,000 or something. People are selling their folks out because they want to go along to get along. And that day is over in our community. We need really independent and very strong elected officials, because somebody's got to, if you don't walk among the youth, if you don't know the youth, number one, you don't know what their needs are. And secondly, you're not the least bit concerned because you don't interact with them enough to even be a victim of them. I made a commitment to young people a long time ago. That's why they called me the hip-hop minister. That's why I was a student minister. When I first started going around speaking to young people, I was younger than many of them. And so my commitment to young people, I've done it poor, I've done it in season, out of season, and I can't get away from it. I still do it. And so I will continue to have that kind of commitment to young people in the council. Same thing I do now, I'll do in there. Same thing.
And you know, comrade, there are many all over the country, concentration camps going up. They are all over the
concentration
country.
What?
Concentration camps or prisons, whatever you want to call them, that are being built all over the country. Of course, they have continued to build new prisons. And also, you know, with the children, you know, you now are getting tickets that create a criminal record for just getting into a schoolyard brawl. And so now I understand in New York, which I'm sure many of the larger metropolitan cities will begin to adopt this stop and frisk policy,
which
also implements a criminal record, depending on what happens during that process. Can you explain to us briefly what is the stop and frisk policy in New York, and what impact has it had on the youth?
Well, you know, first of all, New York, unlike Texas, has very strict gun laws, and that's why Shine, if people remember the rapper Jamal Shine Barrow, he actually went to jail for almost 10 years on a gun charge. He had a gun charge and an assault charge because he shot a bullet and part of it broke off and hit someone. But for pulling the gun, he had a mandatory 7-year sentence. New York has very strict gun laws. You can't walk the streets of New York with a gun. There's no such thing as a concealed weapon or a holstered weapon, and it's very difficult to get a permit to carry in New York. I mean, if you've ever had any legal problems at all, you can forget about carrying a gun in New York. The problem that we have in New York is that we're on the Eastern Seaboard, and we're just a few hours away from Virginia, and people in Virginia can buy as many guns as they want. And so people run up and down the coast buying guns in Virginia, driving them to New York, and they end up on the streets of New York City. It is a problem. There's no question. And this is one area where I agree with Mayor Bloomberg. We got to get the guns off the street in New York. I just left Sing Sing prison, and the men in Sing Sing, in a group called the Forgotten Voices, they said to me, "We know you have to get guns off the street," they said, "because we're in prison. We're killers." They said, "but we can't kill anybody in here because we don't have guns." And so when they said that to me, I understand what they're saying. So one of the things we got to do is get guns on the street. So Commissioner Kelly has said, well, we will implement stop and frisk. The problem with stop and frisk, and that's police basically randomly walking up to individuals, that may be law-abiding citizens, maybe people on their way to work, young, middle-aged, stopping them. The concentration is mostly black men, middle-aged, young black men, Latinos, stopping them when they've committed no crime, there's no probable cause, they haven't done anything, stop them and frisk them. Now, two things. Number one is unconstitutional. Okay, we live in a free society. Sister Gidget, I can stop all the drugs in Houston. What's the worst drug area in Houston?
I would say probably now, Southwest.
I can stop all the drugs in Southwest Houston. If you allow me to use the tactics that the Gestapo used in Nazi Germany, if you can allow me to use the tactics that the secret police used in Stalin's Russia, we just kick the door in on people, no warrants, arrest people, put them in private secret jails, torture people, you can eradicate drugs. I mean, it's possible, but you can't do it in a free society as easily as you can do it in a totalitarian society. And so that is a challenge. We know we have a drug and violence problem, but we cannot give up civil liberties. And that's the mistake we made after 9/11. We were made to be frightened by these people who made us feel like, hey, under these conditions, you can give up your rights as American citizens. So it's unconstitutional. The second thing it does is it puts out a wide net. You know, if you take a commercial fishing net and just throw a wide net in the sea, you're trying to catch sardines, but you end up catching people who have small amounts of marijuana on them, young people, and people are criminalized unnecessarily, and they are drawn into the system. But here's the real catch. 90% of the stops in stop and frisk here in New York, 90+% I might say, yielded no weapon or contraband. And so thousands, tens of thousands of people are having their civil rights violated. They are not guilty of any crime. They are being brought into the system when they shouldn't have been brought into the system, and it's just wrong. It's proven to be ineffective. Law enforcement agencies have said it's ineffective, and yet the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, has stayed tied to this policy. The next mayor that I support would say that Commissioner Kelly has to go. Stop and frisk has been destructive, it's been costly, and it's been ineffective.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So, you know, I understand the policy of trying to get the guns off the street. But
right.
You had mentioned about the young man that you said was shot down for holding a hairbrush. I think his name is Kyle Coppin or something
Kyle
like
Coppin,
that.
Kyle Coppin, yes.
And, you know, we've had many incidences prior to and since Trayvon Martin.
Yes.
And as it stands so far this year, we have lost 2,400 plus young people to gun deaths between the ages of 10 and 24. And this is all violent shootings. This is not accidents. This is not illness. These are 2,400 plus children gone. And so, you know, when it comes to, I don't know if you have Stand Your Ground there, but there has been.
No, we don't have standing ground laws here because, as I said, and that was the interesting thing about rap. You see, one of the reasons why California rap was so violent is because in Texas rap. You can carry guns in Texas, and you never really heard New York rappers rap about guns because you can't carry guns in New York. If you get caught with a gun in New York, there's an automatic 7 years in jail. You can't carry a gun in New York. So anyway, that's not the point you were making, though, and I wanted you to be clear about that. So we don't have stand your ground laws per se.
So, but there still is a significant amount of murders,
killings
New York. And
right.
I just want to know how many incidences involving the police of shootings of innocent young black men or children or people, whatever.
Well, there have been far too many. There have been far too many. We've been fighting this issue, Abner Louima, who wasn't shot, but he was assaulted. But going back, we've been fighting the issue of Amadou Diallo shot 22 times. As you know, we've been fighting this issue in New York for a long time. And I think, you know, many people have made the point that, you know, Gil Scott-Heron had a great song called The Gun. And he said, when other folks give up theirs, I'll give mine. And there are a lot of people who say that you don't want African-American people to be a people without guns and without the ability to defend ourselves. And I understand that. I certainly do the Second Amendment right to bear arms. I get that. And I get in certain areas of the country where guns are more a part of the culture. But the problem we're having here is that, yes, police are killing our young people, but we're killing each other much, much more. When I heard the other day that a 2-year-old had been shot in the head by a 4-year-old, I don't know if you heard about that case. Just
no.
Google that. It was a horrific case, and I don't think it was in New York, but I heard about it. A 2-year-old, indeed, had grabbed a gun from the house and shot a 4-year-old in the head. And that's, you know, again, that's just one more example of there are too many handguns on the street. As you know, these brothers who have these guns, they generally shoot, end up shooting other black people. And for until we get our heads right, we've got to get, a gun is a powerful weapon in the hands of an ignorant person. It is a killing machine. It's like an automobile. A baby driving an automobile, an untrained driver, is a very dangerous thing. And to have access to guns, they say you can buy a gun for $200 on the streets of New York. You got assault weapons, automatic weapons. And I'm not just saying on the streets. I'm talking about in states like Connecticut and the suburbs of New York. We've got to get these assault weapons out of the hands of citizens.
I agree.
Yeah.
And we are winding down, comrade, and I want to ask
you.
Yeah,
we're almost at the end. I thank you so much. Keep up the good work. I love everybody in your listening audience. I pray for everyone for their success. And I just ask that folks will go and visit that website and say, hey, I want to support the brother. I'm going to make a $100 donation, $50, $250, whatever. You can do $1,000. You can give as much as $2,700. If you've got a lot of money, hit the lottery, go donate so that we can win the city council race. And if you live in New York, donate, but also volunteer so that we can really, really do something new in Brooklyn at this time for such a time as this. Sister Gidget, thank you. God bless you. Keep up the good work, okay?
Okay, well, listen, wait a minute. Don't leave me because
we got 2 minutes left. Okay.
I got one more question because I want
to ask you
about your trip to Israel.
Yes, yes. Well, I tell you,
that
I wish we had taken.
Did it have any effect on you?
Did it have any what effect?
Did it have any inspiring effect on you to run for
well,
this campaign?
Well, you know, it did. Israel, the trip was both enlightening, inspiring, and troubling. Obviously, you have tremendous issues in the Middle East, tremendous issues of discrimination against the Palestinians, You have tremendous violence between Palestinians and Jews. You have people on both sides of the equation who have died senseless deaths. You have basically in all too many instances, apartheid apparatuses set up. But it is a great country that has been carved out in the Middle East. I believe in the two-state solution. When you go there, you see how intricately developed that society is. You're going to have a two-state solution. I am against the settlements. I think the settlements, and I visited settlements. I talked to religious fundamentalists, Jewish fundamentalists in those settlements, and those settlements are a problem. We got to get back to the UN mandates. If they're going to sanction the Palestinians for violating the UN sanctions, Israel has to be held account. But I tell you, there's been violence and death for 60 years plus in that region. And I'm talking about 60 years. And I don't ever want people to confuse ancient biblical Israel with historical Israel of the Bible. We cannot conflate the two. It's very important to understand the difference between biblical Israel and Israel of 1948. And that's why I don't say they've been killing each other for thousands of years, because the state of Israel in the contemporary context has only existed since 1948. And when we make the mistake of conflating the Bible with modern geopolitical realities, that is not the way I was trained in seminary. That's not the way biblical historians, archaeologists have been trained. And we need to be clear about that. There's some serious political problems there. Israel has developed into a great country. I pray and trust that the Palestinians will be able to develop a great nation. And it's going to take the United States, the Israelis, and the Palestinians to work together to bring that about. And so it was a great trip. I got a chance to see many of the historic and biblical sites, and those were very inspiring. I saw the tremendous generosity and support from many people cutting across many walks of life, but still I'm deeply troubled by many things that I saw, and we have to be fair and just, because that's what God wants us to be. That's what I'll always be. I'll always call it like I see it. I'm a little bit more tolerant of others' views. I'm a little bit more willing to hear other folks. But at the end of the day, we have to always wrestle with our conscience and speak truth to power and be as best as we can, honest, and speak the truth when we're in a leadership position. So I wish we had more time to talk about that. That was, you know, needed much more time to talk about that complicated issue, but
well,
I'm glad
you
asked me the question.
Back again.
Yeah, we'll come back. We'll come back. Keep up the good work. I've been talking all day, so now I'm going to take leave, and thank you so much. I appreciate you for the time you've given me this evening. Be blessed now.
All right, comrade, thank you
okay.
so much for joining us. And listen, I got a message
uh-huh.
for you.
Sure.
I got a message for you from Brother Kareem, who you talked to from St. Louis. He told me to tell you, whether you know it or not, that your name means brave, bold, ruler, and counsel. And
all
to
right.
get you in the right arena.
All right, all right. I love it. Thank you. Thank him so much. Okay, my sister. I didn't know that, but I'm glad to hear that. I thank you so much. All right. Good night.
Good night. And thank you to my listening audience, all of you who called in by phone, all of you in the chat
yeah.
room. Thank you so much. And I
thank
love you all. And I'll see you back next week. One nation, one love. Assalamu alaikum.
All right.
All right.